Because you appreciate hearing a summary of the latest in science and technology news, we bring you SciPod.
Find out what's new.
Oceanography.
Astronomy.
Medicine.
Botany.
Physics.
Evolution.
Cosmology.
Ecology.
Information technology.
Genetics. Biotechnology.
Mathematics.
Welcome to SciPod, the weekly podcast of New Scientist magazine, and your audio guide to the latest news in science and technology. Hello, I'm Bill Oxley. This week on our February 3rd edition of SciPod, what makes you tick? Looking at how the brain perceives time. Getting a grip. How to build a robot that can handle working in space. And a moving story. A new experiment that explains how your body knows when it's in motion. We'll also find out what your earwax can tell you about your DNA. But first, from the Boston Bureau of New Scientist, here's Ivan Semenek.
Thanks, Bill. Do you ever get that feeling that time is speeding up as life gets more complicated and hectic? Or perhaps you've recently glanced at your watch and felt surprised at the way time has passed, either faster or slower than you expected. It's a common enough feeling, but understanding why we feel that way makes for a challenging scientific problem. This week, New Scientist tackles that problem head-on with a cover story all about how we sense time and recent developments in this intriguing field. Among the researchers you'll meet in the story is Warren Meck. He's a professor in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at Duke University, and his research interests include the neuroanatomical basis for our perception of time. Hello, Dr. Meck. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ivan.
So I think when we try to understand how time works, I can imagine, thinking about the sense of sight or hearing, for example, what I imagine is a physical phenomena like light or sound, and I can picture how that physical phenomena affects the body through some conduit that eventually, our eyes and our ears, and eventually that leads to a perception. Is it as straightforward as that with the perception of time, or what is the equivalent for that time sense that we all seem to have?
Well, actually, that's been a question that's intrigued a lot of my colleagues and myself for many years, and the issue is the clock, the internal clock, is it like the eye or the ear, that when you close your eyes or you close your ears, you stop the impression that's coming into your brain, but can you stop your clock? And the answer is yes, that the sense of time has a texture. It can run faster or slower. It can move in a consistent manner, or it can move in a halting manner. And this is all controlled by a part of the brain that we've identified in recent years that we collectively call the internal clock.
And what is our understanding about how that internal clock works? I mean, what is the timekeeper that's actually ticking away inside us?
Right. Well, the metaphor that's often used is a stopwatch, and that there actually is a pacemaker accumulator system in the brain that allows us to control whether or not we're attending to time or not. And it's controlled by a neurotransmitter called dopamine. And the brain areas that are involved are an area of the cortex called the frontal cortex, and then part of the basal ganglia called the striatum. So the cortex and the striatum work together to serve this pacemaker accumulator function. So it's as if there's a tick-tock, tick-tock, tick-tock going on in the brain that we actually can read, and get a clock reading from.
Now, I know in the New Scientist story, we learn about the pacemaker accumulator model, which you just described, but also more recently, a competing model, I guess, which is called coincidence detection. Can you walk us through that as an alternate?
Sure. Before people understood well the neurobiology and how the brain kept time, they use this stopwatch or this pacemaker accumulator metaphor, and we still use that. That's still the state of the art for behavioral work. But when it comes to the brain circuitry involved, it turns out that the pacemaker accumulator model was a useful but too simplistic of a description. And in fact, rather than pulses that are coming out as ticks, there's really a pattern of oscillating neurons that produce like a symphony. So you're telling time by basically reading many neurons beating with different frequencies, different pulses, and that's called a coincidence detection mechanism. So it's a more sophisticated mechanism, but it's not totally incorrect to refer to it as a pacemaker accumulator. It's just that as we learn more about the way neurons work, we become more sophisticated in our ability to describe that. So I view it as a transition. It is a, is a different model, but it's an evolutionary type model. It builds on the past.
I think it's a wonderful image, this idea of an electrical symphony going on in our brains. Now, but of course, the other thing is we all know that symphony can be altered, I guess, by different brain states that we might have, either altered chemically or perhaps by our moods that seem to affect the passage of time. How is it that different brain states change how we perceive time?
Well, that's actually another question that's intrigued us a lot, that we've known for a while that drugs, stimulant drugs and also sedatives, can actually modulate the speed of this internal clock. But we're now learning more about how, you know, stress in our everyday lives, how arousing traumatic events when we're in accidents or maybe the stress of bungee jumping and things of that sort, but also then altered states of consciousness like meditation. We've learned that these things can slow down that symphony of oscillating neurons, or it can speed them up. And so we're learning to get greater control, not just with drugs, but these other types of techniques, as I said, meditation and arousal states, to actually control our time perception. And I think the goal is to better understand how to modulate time, how to make the clock run faster when we really want to juggle lots of events and accomplish lots of things, and to make the clock run slower when we want to relax and chill out and enjoy time and not feel so stressed. So I think that's an excellent, question, and we need to develop more techniques.
Now, that certainly helps explain how one brain or one individual can sense time differently at different times or in different states of mind. What about differences between people? I mean, to go back to the sight metaphor, certainly there is a population of people who are colorblind to some extent or have a slightly different sense of sight than the rest. Is it possible? Are there time-blind people, or are there people who simply seem to operate or perceive time in a different way?
Yes, I think that there are a number of things that people might be familiar with. So when Oliver Sacks, when he wrote the book and had the film Awakenings, that there are people with various neurodegenerative states that they're frozen in time, and that if they're given the proper medication, their clocks can start ticking, they're operating again, and they can perceive time. But that would be a type of blindness, temporal blindness, that there isn't normally something that's extreme, but as we age, our clocks slow down. So though older individuals aren't blind to time, they perceive time more slowly, and it's as if they lose track of time.
Well, and the losing track of time is an interesting phenomenon. Of course, I think we all know people, maybe we are the people who are frequently late or seem to just not sense time exactly the way other people do who are more punctual. And you kind of wonder, is that just a personality trait? Is there some neurological basis to that personality difference? Because there do seem to be those differences.
Right. That would come under a category that we might call attention deficit disorder. So people who have an inability to attend to lots of events in their lives also have an inability to attend to time. So they lose track of it. It's as if time is flickering on and off. It's as if the stopwatch runs for a little while, stops, halts, flickers, if you will, then runs a little bit more, and then stops and halts. And so the idea of having a jumbled sort of time sense is a problem with attention deficit disorder. And so drugs or stimulants like methylphenidate or Ritalin actually dramatically improves that. And it does so by increasing the speed of the clock.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Mack, for taking the time to speak to us about it.
Well, thank you, Ivan. It's been a pleasure to timeshare with you.
Very good. Dr. Warren Mack is a neuroscientist at Duke University, and he spoke to us from Durham, North Carolina. And if you want to know more, then don't forget to schedule in some time to read this week's New Scientist cover story. It's all about your brain on time.
You're listening to SciPod, the podcast of New Scientist magazine.
And now, from the San Francisco Bureau of New Scientist, here is Jessica Marshall.
Put your hand behind your back. Now wiggle your finger. How do you know it moved? For more than a century, scientists have been trying to figure out how the body knows where its limbs are. They've wondered whether receptors on the skin, joints, and muscles report the information back to the brain, or whether the brain's motor commands alone create the sensation of movement. Now, a new study may have the answer. The work comes from a team at the Prince of Wales Medical Research Institute in Sydney, Australia. The team numbed the forearms of volunteers to create the sensation of a phantom hand. The participants believed that their hands were tightly clenched, but in fact, their numb fingers were fully extended. When the volunteers were then asked to flex or extend their wrists, they consistently reported that the position of their hand had changed to comply with the researcher's command. In truth, their hand hadn't moved at all. According to the researchers, this finding shows that orders from the brain are all that's needed to convince a person that they've moved their body. In technology news, everybody dreads the worm. Computer worms wriggle their way into home computers and IT networks everywhere, exploiting the system's weak points and wreaking havoc. But now, the battle of the worms begins, as software engineers develop new worms designed to do good, not evil. In theory, these noble worms will spread through networks and patch vulnerable computers before the bad worms get there. It's not a new idea. Virus-writing gangs have used such patching worms to stop the spread of bad worms deployed by their rivals. But one worry about these patching worms is that they might cause systems to crash if they make their way into computers that they're not designed to fix. One solution might be worms with better manners. These polite worms would ask permission from a network's central server before invading and spreading their good deeds. One Florida firm is putting this idea into practice. The company Immunity is developing software for programmers to create their own friendly software wrigglers that they hope will be on sale within 4 years. And finally, is your earwax brown and sticky or pale and dry? It may seem like a personal question, but according to a new study, the answer can tell you something about your DNA. Dry earwax is a recessive trait that's common among East Asians. People with dry earwax don't actually make wax at all. Their wax consists of the usual dead skin and dirt, but lacks the oily stuff made by glands in the ear that characterizes wet earwax. Most people of European and African origin have wet earwax. A team from Nagasaki University in Japan looked at DNA samples from people with both types of earwax and found that the difference between them was just one gene. That gene is also associated with the cell's ability to rid itself of certain drugs. The researchers suspect this drug pump also dumps out the oils that make up wet earwax. The gene is mutated in people with dry earwax. Since their pump doesn't work normally, they don't make wax. The researchers say the mutation that causes dry earwax probably arose in Northeast Asia and spread from there. Researchers plan to study the drug pump further to shed light on this sticky situation.
We hope you're enjoying this edition of SciPod, and we would love to know what you think of our podcast. If you'd like to share your thoughts with us, please complete our short podcast survey. It's easy. Just visit newscientist.com/podcast and follow the links to get the survey. Now, once again, here's Ivan Semenek.
Thanks, Bill. Robots are on the move these days. Already 1.5 million Roomba vacuum cleaning bots are sucking their way over carpets all around the globe. Two autonomous rovers are still hard at work on Mars, and this is only the start of what engineers are hoping to achieve. This week, New Scientist presents a special report on the most stunning advances in humanoid robots, robots that are built to do what we do. They are pushing the boundaries of robotic locomotion, speech, and dexterity. And it's recent developments in these three areas that will likely lead to a new generation of human-like machines. Today we're going to concentrate on just one of those areas, dexterity, which includes the ability to hold and manipulate tools and other objects. These days, if you want to see the cutting edge of mechanical dexterity, the place to go is the Johnson Space Center. It's home to NASA's core of astronauts, of course, but it's also home to Robonaut, possibly the most dexterous machine on Earth, and maybe someday in space, too. Joining us now is Ron Diffler. He's an engineer and project manager for Robonaut. He's at the Johnson Space Center. Hello and welcome.
Hello.
So, Ron, could you describe Robonaut for us? Is this the kind of robot you could shake hands with?
Certainly. Robonaut is a humanoid robot, like you mentioned. It is designed with similar body parts to a human. It's got two arms, two hands, a neck, a camera platform mounted inside a helmet, which looks very much like a head. It's mounted on a single leg that gives it roughly the same size as an astronaut would have when positioned in their portable foot restraints in low Earth orbit.
So it seems clear that we would recognize this as a human form. And what about how it moves, what it does? Does it also seem human in its motion?
Actually, very much so. We've done certain tests where we've looked at the Robonaut from the rear, just looking down, say, its shoulder, and you'd be hard-pressed to tell the difference between its motion and a human arm motion if you didn't look back far enough to examine the other parts that are clearly robotic.
That's amazing. And, you know, when I think of human dexterity, or I guess any kind of animal dexterity, your mind is full of these images of fluid movements and all the degrees of freedom that you get with the joints and the muscles. What's the design philosophy that gets you to a robot that can do that kind of movement?
Well, our motivation was to assist the astronauts, and the goal there being to use the same tools, work within the same interfaces. So that drove us towards the human form, because all those interfaces and tools were already designed for humans.
So why don't you walk us through a task? How is the command or the knowledge of how to perform those movements getting to the robot?
We have multiple modes for that. When we first try a new task, we normally control the robot through what we call teleoperation. That is, we have a human put on a collection of virtual reality gear, which in this case we call robot reality gear. Say, for example, gloves that measure the finger positions on the human, sensors that are put on the back of a human's palm, so as you move your arm around in space, we track your position. And what this allows us to do is to, and we also put a helmet on that we can see through the robot's eyes. It allows the teleoperator to be immersed in the robot's environment, and then whatever motion the teleoperator makes, the robot makes. It allows for very intuitive control and a very good way of examining and performing a task for the first time. Based on experiments using this approach, we then later build up what we call primitives and transfer more of the control over to the robot. So it will then, for a specific task, go out and perform part of the task automatically. Say, for example, we have a tool you want to pick up, like you mentioned. The robot would, using its machine vision, identify the tool based on what it has in its memory, and then locate that position, then command its arm to move out, move around the tool so it has a pre-grasp position, then close its hand to acquire the tool.
That's amazing, and I guess you could really see moving forward where that might be helpful in terms of space exploration. Of course, if you're in orbit around the Earth, the time delay in getting a robot to work or to moving a robot is very short. But if you imagine robots on Mars or other distant locations in the solar system, they have to really move autonomously, don't they, in order to get things done?
And that's the second mode I had described, which we developed based on partially teleoperation experience. So we're actually working on a new teleoperation station now that allows us to deal with time delays that vary from 2 to 10 seconds. This is more or less the time frame that is appropriate for lunar work. We would control the robot from the ground using what we call predictive displays. That is, it would be a graphical environment that shows us what real-time, what's in the actual environment. We would interact with these graphical icons and devices in real-time, and then the robot would take these commands 10 seconds, 2 to 10 seconds later, and then perform the actual task. But we would stay far enough ahead of the robot, watching what it's doing, that if for some reason we want to change the task, we could stop it somewhere along the way.
And as you're saying, these movements ultimately have a sense of being uncannily human. I'm wondering where the real challenge is in pushing this movement further and making it even more human. Is it in the design of the hardware, the structure of the robot, or is it in the software that will allow it to make these movements?
Well, fortunately for me, there are lots of challenges. I'd say one of the biggest is miniaturization. Trying to reproduce the motion and the package size we would like, and giving ourselves all the sensing we would like. We have quite a bit of sensing now, but we're not sitting on our laurels, and we're trying to add more. And then beyond that is the automation problem in general. There are many challenges to having a robot being able to deal with a task that's not well known in advance. And we're attacking both of these.
Excellent. And I just want to finish off by asking you what you think you would like to see Robonaut doing. I'm wondering, first of all, what its highest achievement is in your mind, and in terms of a specific task, and what hurdle you're hoping, or what milestone you're hoping to take it to.
I think our most important achievement to date is our ability to work directly with a suited crew member wearing a pressurized spacesuit. that was a very important task for us, that we could work next to them. We've dealt with all the safety issues of working closely with humans, and we've done a good job in helping the human be more productive in this high-fidelity environment of wearing a spacesuit. Further on, we'd like to see Robonaut fly, of course, and we'd like to see it go on planetary missions, or at least a version of Robonaut that's appropriate for a planetary mission, to go to the Moon and to Mars with crew.
That's great. Well, we're certainly looking forward to that, and we wish you well.
Well, thank you very much.
Ron Diffler spoke to us from NASA's Johnson Space Center. To find out more about Robonaut, along with many other fascinating advances in robotics technology, check out the robot special in this week's edition of New Scientist.
Planet, life, body, mind. NewScientist.com. From the infinitely large to the fleetingly fast, NewScientist.com. It's your online resource to science, nature, and technology. With daily stories about cloning, climate change, stem cells, nanotechnology, evolution. Your world runs on science. Don't let that world pass you by. Visit NewScientist.com today.
Well, that just about wraps up this week's edition of SciPod, but it's only the beginning of what you can find in the February 4th edition of New Scientist magazine. Also in this week's issue, Hold the Phone, an in-depth report on the controversial science of cell phone safety. Smog Block, pigeons take wing and help scientists monitor air quality. Doing battle with bogus science, an interview with physicist Robert Park. All this plus lots more science and technology news, features, and opinion. Remember, only New Scientist brings you the week's best ideas. I'm Bill Oxley. Join us next week and find out what's new on SciPod.
Mission control. Transmission concluded.